You can't delegate digital transformation for your company. You and your executives have to own it. Executives need to engage, embrace, and adopt new ways of working with the latest in emerging technologies. And that's where we come in. Welcome to Embracing Change. The business world is changing at a faster pace than it ever has, and companies need to keep up. We interview the most interesting CEOs, CMOs, and other executives to talk about their challenges with digital transformation in their industry. This is Embracing Change, and this is your host, Gerardo Carrick.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Embracing Change, where we talk about digital transformation in different industries. My guest today is Eugenio Mendez, Chief Revenue Officer of PopSockets. Hi, Eugenio. How are you?
Hi, Gerardo. It's a pleasure.
How you been?
Great, great. Thank you so much.
No, thank you for, you know, for accepting to have a conversation with us. Well, Eugenio is one of a number of guests that we've had in this podcast that come from the famous pedigree of Coca-Cola. I've met Eugenio a number of years back here in Atlanta, because Coca-Cola is also here in Atlanta, where I'm based, and we've known each other for a number of years. Eugenio, why don't you tell our guest just a little bit about your background and experience before PopSockets?
Yeah, of course, Gerardo. I'm one of those persons that have been going through a journey of experimenting sides of multinationals and now startups, right? So I couldn't live without the itch of learning and understanding how each of these types of companies behave and work. So I started my career at Coca-Cola in 1993 in Mexico. 10 years there, then moved to the global offices here in Atlanta for 5 years. I moved to London, working for Bacardi. That was the first time I moved out of my alma mater, which was Coca-Cola, to Bacardi Global Brands. They were based in London. I spent three years and a half with them for me to come back to Coca-Cola Atlanta once again for the second time. For about 6 years in numerous roles throughout my 23-year career at Coke. And that's when, in that last phase, I started to be more interested and curious about the performance and the behavior of startups. And in a role of advisory, I joined the advisory board of Charlotte's Web, a CBD company, in 2017, when the CBD, trends were just going crazy. And I was their advisory board. 3 years later, I decided to join that company. I moved to Boulder, Colorado for 1 year. And then I left the company after 1 year of my tenure there, just to meet David Barnett, the founder of PopSockets, in a very random way. And just being mesmerized by his invention and the stories that he was telling me about how he came up with this idea and how far he has gone. So I say, okay, I need to be part of that excitement. And he invited me to join the company back in 2020, just before the pandemic.
Wow. And the rest is history.
And well, we continue, you know, writing history here. So so we'll see, how far this history goes.
I find the product fascinating, right? Because and by the way, you and I, we share some similar parts of our background, because I also worked in, as you know, in the spirits industry out of London, right? So I was working for Diageo, which is one of the big players over there with Bacardi, of course, right? So it's interesting. We should talk a little bit about that as well at some point of the podcast. But what I find very, very interesting about the product, about PopSockets in particular, is that it is a physical product, right? It is, it's a physical widget, as physical widgets get, right?
Yeah.
But it's totally attached to a to a digital trend, right? There's been an increase in the use of mobile phones because of all of the things that mobile phones allows us to do, right? So yeah. It's one of those cases where you have a physical product that it's actually the result, you know, its growth is a result of digital transformation and digital trends, right? In a way.
It did, yeah. And the story that David Barnett had is mesmerizing. I mean, he was a professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado. And at that time, you know, we're talking about 2014, you know, they were just like your earphones. There were no like AirPods. So everything had a cable. Mm-hmm. And he was frustrated that his cable, when he was putting it on his pocket, that the earphones were all tangled. Mm-hmm. And for him just to like untangle them was just frustrating. Mm-hmm. So he said, like, what if there was something? And he said, like, I always use my earphones with my phone. Mm-hmm. So what if there was something in the phone where I could just like wrap up my earphones? Mm-hmm. And so he went to a store and then found this like socket and he, you know, glued it in the back of the phone, just put it there and voila, that was at that point the solution to his problem. Mm-hmm. He had the benefit of spending days and hours and hours and hours with students, with mm-hmm. young people who was watching this thing, and then suddenly they just realized that had more utility than what they were thinking. Because you could actually hold the phone mm-hmm. much better. Mm-hmm. So the idea evolved from, it's a place where I put my earphones to, no, it's a place that I can hold my phone so I don't drop it. So, mm-hmm. no, because I could just like do this and I would not drop my phone. And the other thing that is brilliant is that before this, the way you hold your phone is with your pinky, you know, mm-hmm. here. And over mm-hmm. time, I mean, we're spending our you know, hours and hours and hours using our phones. Mm-hmm. And we're damaging our fingers. Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course.
And so with this, you don't have to have that problem anymore. Mm-hmm. Plus, you can mount it and put, you know, the other accessories. And
now you can put it in the car. You know, there's so many other utilities to it. Yeah,
and you can and over innovation, we found a way to change it. So you can, if I want to change to a different, design, then I would just switch it and change it to another one. So he found the perfect balance between something that you use every day, many times a day or many hours a day, mm-hmm. with personalization, with your personality, with fashion. And that is a sweet spot. And since
personalization, yeah.
Yeah, and since, I mean, right now I have my Clear, which I love because, you know, I can showcase my phone. This is the one that I like the most. But I can change this, you know, if I go to a wedding, I can put something different. If I go to an event, I can put something with a logo, mm-hmm. et cetera. So personalization is huge. Showing my personality is huge. And since then, we have sold about 270 million pop grips in the world.
Wow, wow, wow! It's fascinating to me how. How ideas come to life and how they can become a business, as long as you're finding a solution for a problem, right? As long as you're finding a real solution for an existing problem, you know, and of course it's a problem that exists at scale, right? Because there's so many people using phones that the market is huge. So if you find a solution, it doesn't have to be a huge solution, you have a massive market. Right. And if you add to it all of the innovation and all of the personalization, which is a huge trend, by the way. I mean, you see that in tattoos, for example, right? We, actually, in our agency, we've signed a couple of online tattoo producers, right? You know, stickers that they're also growing at a very fast rate because people want to personalize their bodies, right? Personalize without the commitment. right? So correct, this whole concept of personalization and being able to communicate how you feel one day or be able to adapt, as you said, to am I going to an event? Am I going to a wedding? Am I going to be with my friends? What I want my look to tell about me, right?
It's a huge trend. It's been, I mean, forever. I mean, before the Industrial Revolution, everything was personalized. Everything was like artisanal, so it was done for you.
Yeah.
Then came the machines, right? Mm-hmm. And everything became standardized. Mm-hmm. And we lost the personalization for many, many years. Decades. Until technology mm-hmm. came in with this concept of mass personalization. And that's, mm-hmm. it was a futuristic idea maybe 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. But in the last, 15 years with technology, printers, 3D printers, etc., computers, we have been able to materialize that idea of mass personalization. Mm-hmm. And now to the point that actually we can go back to the artisanal years of having something specifically for you, but that can be done at scale.
Of course, of course. So something I'm very interested in asking you, okay? It's about a product like PopSockets, right? It's available in retail, it's available online, it's available through Amazon, it's fully omnichannel, right? How do you achieve, or what are the challenges to achieve an omnichannel balance? You know, in the sense of price equalization and to show a common brand across all of these different retailers direct to consumer channels. You know, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one, we would like to design these things, you know, way, way in advance, so everything goes perfect. Like companies, especially startups, they never start with an omnichannel, you know, mindset, because what they do at the beginning is just sell whatever they can, or however they can. And right now, also in the last 20 to 15 years, the surgence of e-commerce has become the place where startups can sell mm-hmm. at a certain level of scale, mm-hmm. because you know retailers don't know you. Retailers are cautious of which kind of brands they bring in, mm-hmm. and they're not that open to pick up whatever brand they see out there without any kind of like support, financial support, professionalism, salespeople, etc. And startups don't have that. Mm-hmm. Startups, when they are starting, it has like the founder, three people, and end of story.
And that's it, yeah.
So I think the story of omnichannel is more a story of a successful progress of an enterprise. Mm-hmm. You normally start very small. You normally start either like selling. It could go two ways. Like either you sell online. Mm-hmm. Now in Amazon is an interesting platform to do that. Or you're selling a very small geography mm-hmm. or stores that know you, that you can actually walk there and just like start like putting your displays and taking care of your product. So it's always very limited what you do at the beginning, trying mm-hmm. to find a community that gets excited about your product. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that community gets truly excited about your product and starts spreading the word. And then this thing takes off. In the case of PopSockets, that happened very fast, because what happened is that we started at an online. The word started to spread out, but through celebrities. The celebrities uh-huh. started to use the product.
But let me interrupt you there. But was that intentional? I mean, was that following an influencer strategy, or is just that a celebrity picked it up because they
at the time they liked the product? Exist. The concept of influencer strategy didn't exist as it is today. Uh-huh. And it was just that it was placed in the right stores. David was very careful of merchandising the product on online in one hand, mm-hmm. and then in very strategic like boutique stores. or you know, very boutique retailers.
Premium placement.
That's where the celebrities go. And they figure out this was a very interesting idea, and they started to use it. So when you get that level of sponsorship, and it was free at the time, we didn't pay for that, then it spreads like wildfire. And in 1 year, I mean, the company went from like $4 or $5 million of sales to $100 million of sales.
Wow, and that fast.
That happened because some of the retailers are always looking at what is hot out there. And in 2017, Target knocked the door and said, like, I'm interested in your product. And once you get to that level of retailer, so once again, you start small in your online community and very small, like stores or limited distribution stores, until one mass retailer comes to you and is interested in your product. And that day, I mean, Target has almost 2,000 stores across the country, and then in one day you multiply your sales by 2,000.
Wow! So tell me about, you know, that is one of the number one reason for companies to disappear. You know, growth management, right? You know, suddenly you get into a retailer like Target, and they have 2,000 stores, and they want you everywhere, and now you need the lines of credit to be able to create all of the production. You know, send it to the retailer. Hope the product sells, because if it doesn't sell, then you know now you're in that squeeze, right? So obviously it's not the case with PopSocket. PopSocket has been a huge success, but tell me about those risks, because those risks are huge. You know, there's a lot of companies that's the point where they either make it or they're broken.
Well, I mean, I think it comes down honestly to your supply chain and well, starting with the design of your product. I think great products are simple by nature. Their design, their way they're built are the simplest version of the best product they can make. If they're well designed, then they can scale up quickly. If they're very complex, if PopSockets had, 25 components, it would be very, very difficult to scale up quickly.
Production.
They just have only three.
Yeah.
Three components, a very, very simple design. And at the moment you get that level of distribution and sales, it's just a matter that your supply chain is ready to scale up quickly. Now, retailers know that, and they're good partners. So they allow you to kind of like keep up with the pace. They don't have to sell in all 2,000 stores in the same month. I mean, you can start scaling up 1,000 stores. Oh, sorry, 100 stores first, 500 next, 1,000 next. So it is possible to negotiate with your partners, with your retailers, or Amazon, or your own e-commerce, how fast you can grow, right? So you don't break the system. But you know, once you have the capability built and the capacity built, it just go fast, because once you have this, back to the omnichannel piece, once you have these trend-setting retailers moving in and being successful, everybody wants a product.
Yeah.
So then you go from 2,000 stores to 100,000 stores in 2-3 years.
Yeah.
And that's when the channel management becomes critical, because your velocities started to reduce, or you reach a peak. And then some other, not all doors are equal in terms of productivity, in terms of a shopping mission, in terms of people really like interested in buying the product there, et cetera. So you have to be careful of not overextending the brand in a way that then your product doesn't sell and it comes back with all sorts of like reverse logistic nightmares. That's when your strategy is so, so important, to maintain the right channel, the right customers, with the right execution, right price, or right suggested price, and then just let the dynamics of the market work in its own way. Then mm-hmm. you have to manage, because retailers know that they don't want to fall into a price war. Mm-hmm. They just want to make sure that they don't lose competitiveness with mm-hmm. themselves. So we suggest the price, and everybody follows the price as in their best of their interests.
Of course. So let's talk about the product itself, right? Let's talk about the product and the customer segmentation. Okay, so how important is segmentation in a product like this? Which, in its own, it looks like one product. I know it's not, but it looks like one simple product, as you said, you know, very simply designed. You know, if you don't think too much about it, you think, okay, how much segmentation do I need for this? But actually, because of all the personalization, you have a lot of ability for segmentation, right? So how important is segmentation for a product like this? That it's a simple product, that it's highly personalizable. Is that a word?
Yeah. Well, segmentation is critical. One is obviously it's a channel segmentation. We talked about that already. Consumer segmentation is also very important. And I do believe that great ideas start by being disciplined and focused, right? If you want to cover too many segments at the same time, you most probably will not be anything to anybody. Mm-hmm. So you have to pick the customer and the community that is more interested at the beginning about your product. The beauty of some of these ideas that pick up quickly is that community, it's created by itself very quickly. So founders can realize, oh, I am successful with this group of people. Mm-hmm. Which in the case for PopSockets was, at the time, were the millennial women. Mm-hmm. Now they're millennial moms, but at that time they were younger. And most probably they were not married, but they were already like a late high school, beginning of college. And what they liked a lot was accessorizing their phones.
Oh, so accessorizing was the initial drive.
Yeah, because obviously they understood the benefit of the functional benefit, because also for women they have smaller hands and bigger phones. The Pro Max and all the Max phones, mm-hmm. Women prefer those phones. So they are big and heavy, mm-hmm. and they have smaller hands and more delicate mm-hmm. hands. So a PopSocket was really helping them to kind of like hold the phone much better.
Yeah, let me just interrupt you there because that's what I was thinking when I was thinking about segmentation. You know, do you segment by demographics or do you segment by use cases, right? Because there's so many use cases for this, right? There's the people that want, like the founder, you know, the utility piece where I can actually use it for that utility. There's the people like me that I discovered PopSockets because my hand was hurting and my doctor said you need to figure out a way that enables your hand to have a more natural grip, and that's how I discovered PopSockets 4 years ago. And then there's the people that want the personalization right? So, and each of those are different use cases for the same product.
Yeah. But a lot of this is a journey. Mm-hmm. Founders go about finding their own journey as the years pass, and they talk to customers. I think that's really important, is that you keep yourself very close to your customers to understand what else they're finding mm-hmm. about the product. Right. Mm-hmm. So and then we define the key motivation or the key drivers for buying a product. Right. So, yeah, it started as a functional thing, just to hold your phone and then accessorize. It's like, look how pretty my PopSockets makes my phone look up from mm-hmm. the back. Mm-hmm. And then selfies were cooler. Right, because all the selfies were taken in a mirror, mm-hmm. and they were portraying. So it was honestly an element of vanity that millennial women started to pick up. From there, we saw that there's a kind of like an orthopedic benefit to it that could help, you know, older consumers, although we are not like fully targeting that so far. But, you know, for older people, it's much easier to hold a phone.
You just call me old?
No, you didn't answer that old. But my parents have it and they just love it because they don't.
Yeah. I am also, that's why.
Drop the phone. But you will find other usages as we go. And we have invented, you know, now this is the best innovation right now with iPhone 12 and up, MagSafe. You know, so now you don't have to stick the product in the back of the phone with the adhesive. Now we use magnets. So you can remove it, put your, wireless charger. So it's all about knowing what's going on, knowing how people are using their phones, and also how the manufacturers of phones like Apple, Samsung, etc., are evolving their ideas, and then you being on top of that fast.
That's interesting. The whole concept of innovation on a product that is so simple, right? But that simple innovation is so key, right? So the use of magnets is. It's such a game changer for pop sockets, right? Because in the past, you would put it on a case, you would stick it, and then when you change your phone, you have to start again, right?
Yeah.
And now with this, you can actually transfer it.
Yeah, you can move it from one phone
to the other. What happened during the pandemic, Eugenio? When people stopped going to supermarkets as much and started doing online shopping way more, did PopSocket had to go through a transformation as well, like many businesses?
Well, we did have a decent presence on e-commerce. Back again to our omnichannel strategy. Before the pandemic, we already had a solid e-commerce business with a talented team behind it. We were in the very beginning of understanding Amazon better. So we started to build a team at the time. It was not that strong before the pandemic. And then we had a strong, you know, retail presence. So when the pandemic hits, actually I thought there was gonna be a real disaster because I thought people will completely, you know, forget about buying a product that is more fashionable and really, really focus on health. That was my understanding. Mm-hmm. I was mistaken, because at the end of the day, what happened is that people ended up in their houses using their electronics at a much, much higher
rate
than ever before. So the need for a pop socket actually during the pandemic was higher than ever before, because now our life was attached to this. And because people couldn't travel, because people couldn't spend a lot of money on clothing and all that, all that money went into electronics and upgrading phones and electronics at home. So what happened was that many of our retailers closed. The two biggest didn't, Walmart, Target, did not. So we grew on Walmart Target significantly. We grew significantly on Amazon, and our e-commerce, you know, doubled in size. So everything, by having that ability, that flexibility, it's like having a portfolio, right?
Yeah.
So you don't put all your eggs in one basket, and you allow yourself, because now it's so uncertain, things are so uncertain, that you don't know, you know, how consumers are going to switch. And I think what the pandemic did from a consumer standpoint was to maximize the movement from channel to channel. People now seamlessly, in one day or 1 hour, go from e-commerce to Amazon to a retailer. And they can switch. So if you don't have that flexibility and that muscle build in your business, when the pendulum swings, which we don't know when it's going to happen, you can suffer. So managing that was very, very critical for us in the pandemic. And more so today, because now it's even more uncertain than during the pandemic. At least in the pandemic, we knew where we were.
In what sense is more uncertain?
Well, I think the world became very uncertain, right? I mean, the Russia war kind of like threw everything out of whack because nobody was expecting it. Everybody was ready to come out to a normal world with vaccinations and no masks and all of that. And then suddenly, you know, the war, the Russia-Ukraine war changed the economic perspectives that hit the US by double the price of gas, significant inflation on food, on essentials, and therefore less money to spend. And that money that we had, we preferred to spend it by traveling. We didn't want to stay home anymore. So the dynamics changed significantly, and that became very, very uncertain. Now, 2023 seems to be, okay, that was 2022. In the middle of that, retailers got caught because everybody thought that we were coming back to normal in 2022. We got caught with significant amounts of inventories of everything. So Target, Walmart, you look at their earnings and their issues on Q1, Q2, 2022 were significant inventories of everything. So then retailers had to kind of like manage inventories, hold, you know, purchases from suppliers, and that threw, you know, another like curve to many, many companies. 2023 seems to be so far a little more stable until now, until last week when the banks started to kind of like, you know, part. So once again, what level of uncertainty we're going to start suffering, and what and how companies will have to adapt to whatever you know, the results and the consequences of this uncertainty will create.
Of course. Well, that's a. It seems that we need to start getting used to not knowing.
Correct. Right? More than ever.
More than ever, for sure. But I think that, you know, the insight, and you touched upon this at the beginning of this section, which is, to me, the insight is to have a diverse portfolio of channels for sales, right? In this case, you know, this omni-channel strategy is really like when a salesperson, right? You know, let's say a business development executive, you know, they have their lead generation channels, right? If they only have one channel and that channel stops, then they're totally exposed to that channel, right? But if you're actually having 7, 8, 9 different, they're like the pillars for a house, right? So you know that if you have several, even if one or two fall, the roof is not falling on top of you, right? The house is sustained because the weight can be lifted. But if you just have a few, then you're very, very exposed. And I think in this case, it's a great example of how having this omni-channel strategy allowed you to be very, you know, very nimble in the sense of moving the business to where growth was coming from, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think to the multinational experience, multinationals are so strong. It's because they have a massive portfolio in different levels that protect them from anything in the future, because they have multiple products in different categories that if one category falls, the other one grows, right? So they're always like compensating. The question is, how do you make sure that both of them are profitable enough so your profitability doesn't fall when this one highly profitable falls and the other one that is not as profitable grows.
Well, you just reminded me of something, right? In the late 90s, when we had a crisis, economic crisis, global economic crisis, and I was working in the spirits industry. I was a brand manager, global brand manager for Johnnie Walker, right? Whiskey. Mm-hmm. And Johnnie Walker has...
highly profitable.
very highly profitable, but you have the super expensive premium whiskeys, mm-hmm. you know, blue, gold, etc. And then you have the flagship, which is gold, black. And then you have the standard, which is red, right? And at that time, black was the, as I said, the flagship for, you know, for Johnnie Walker. But when the crisis happened and people could not pay for their premium whiskeys, what do you think they did? You know, they still wanted to drink whiskey, but yeah. they basically went down a category, right? But instead of going to a competitor, you know, all of those drinkers moved down to Johnnie Walker Red instead of going to another brand. So I think you just made me think about that, because I remember those years we clicked probably the highest growth of Johnnie Walker Red in history, right? Because we were capturing all of those premium and super premium customers that were loyal to the brand, but you know, but could not afford those prices at that point, right? And I think it's an example of what you were just describing. You know, yeah. these massive companies that have products at every level, at every price point, that build brand audiences and these global brands to capture these global customers, and they, you know, that gives them that ability to be able to move people across categories and across price brackets, right?
Yeah. So now we have talked about two layers. One, the first layer was channel. The second layer now we're talking about categories and price points, right? And you can apply that to any product. Pop sockets, we have a $10 bracket, a $15 bracket, a $25 bracket, even we have grapes that cost $50 to $100. Mm-hmm. You know? So the second layer is category. And the third layer is geographies. Because then you play the world, right? Mm-hmm. Then you expand in the world. Now, it's easier for multinationals that have been in the world for 100 and more years than for startups that they need to be very selective of where they go, because it's very expensive to expand geographically. But, you know, right now, PopSockets is growing triple digits in China. Mm-hmm. We are growing 75% in Latin America, mm-hmm. while the U.S. is more a smaller and
it's a stable market.
Modest, you know, growth.
Yeah.
But then you and sometimes, you know, China goes into a crisis and then it's compensated by the U.S., etc. So you also play the dynamics of a globalized world.
So what are the challenges of expanding internationally for a startup? Like, you know, we keep calling it startup. It's a larger company now. But you know, what are the challenges? You know, when it comes to growth, right? You know, when you start as a company from Colorado, that suddenly becomes national, and now it's trying, because I think that's where your international experience as well is being very, very helpful, right?
I was brought in because of that, but I call PopSockets a startup because we behave like a startup, but we are really a scale-up company now. Mm-hmm. This is proven, the case is proven, we are profitable. And then now we're scaling up this model. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the biggest challenge is resources. Mm-hmm. Is because if you want to go with a lack of discipline on where the opportunity is higher, is bigger first, mm-hmm. you ended up like fragmenting your resources significantly, both financial and human resources, which is the most important things you have. So what you need to do, the biggest challenge is to convince yourself to be focused, that it's better to be invested in fewer but sounder markets than everywhere. Mm-hmm. Sometimes for ego purposes, you would say, oh, okay, we sell in 100 countries, but you're not building the brand, you're just like distributing it and it doesn't rotate. So it's mm-hmm. better to say, no, we're focused on 6 markets mm-hmm. and these are my most win markets and I'm investing on them. Mm-hmm. Now, each time you go to a market, you need to, I mean, depending on the region, but you need to set up entities. You have fiscal exposure. So it's not just going there and build up your presence. No, then you need to have lawyers, you need to have accountants, you need to have logistics, you know, experts. You need to build up your infrastructure of e-commerce, logistics, etc. Mm-hmm. For you to even think about getting into a position in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's all about resources, because, you know, 60 countries will require 60 different understanding of accounting and regulatory environments and fiscal environments, etc. And so you need more lawyers and more accountants to do that.
Of course. So I think we're coming to an end on this podcast, but I have it's almost like a personal question to you to ask, right? Which is, having worked in massive global organizations like Coke and Bacardi, and also in startups like Charlotte's Web and PopSockets, how do you compare and contrast, and on a personal level, for somebody thinking about, let's say, starting their career and thinking about, you know, going to a massive corporation or working on an established startup, you know, what would you say to them? So your personal reflection and then your advice.
Yeah, I mean, my first comment to this is, there's no formula. Mm-hmm. So the way I have been able to progress in my career and the steps that I've been taking in my career doesn't mean that my formula is successful or not, right? It all depends on where you are and what, and whether you're enjoying what you're doing, etc.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, multinationals are a great place to learn. Mm-hmm. You know, they are sophisticated, they are very well established, they have resources to teach you, you know, how to do business. But they normally teach you a specialization. So you mm-hmm. will know very well a piece of the whole puzzle because the company is so big.
Mm-hmm.
But you will learn it at a world-class level, and you will be exposed to experiences that it's going to be very hard for an entrepreneur to learn, you know, at that level of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
The counterpart of that is that then everything is slow, is bureaucratic and political,
mm-hmm.
right? And then you need to navigate all of those things. And for us who have lived and worked in those environments, it's not fun. That part is the part that is not that fun. And so,
especially as you grow and you go to senior levels of the organization, and you do less of the actual work and you do more of the political maneuvering, right?
Yeah.
Meaning getting approvals and
trying to move things is much, much slower and harder. And then you see these startups kind of like eating your lunch, and then you just get more frustrated and frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's you know, the good and the opportunities of multinationals. On the other side, you have startups that are just fast, right? And they're scrappy, they don't have resources, but they're very creative, and, you know, sky's the limit, and decisions are made in 1 second, and you can see the impact, and you learn and reapply, etc. So it's a very dynamic environment.
Mm-hmm.
But it's frustrating also because you don't have the money to do everything that you would like to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen, obviously, people, founders like David, with no knowledge, never worked in a multinational, never did any of that, being super successful. And the same way I've seen, you know, CEOs of multinational companies, you know, going through all those careers and growing in a very steady way, being super successful as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think in my personal experience or in my personal choice, I wanted to feel what it's like to be in both sides,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I've been doing. So I'm not regretting it.
Of course, of course. Excellent, Eugenio. Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your insights, for telling us the story of what you've done with your career, and also the story of PopSockets, and this fascinating story of starting as an idea to solve my problem to becoming a multinational success. Really, really appreciate it. I hope I can invite you to another future podcast at some point. Let's talk about that. And thank you so much for your time, okay?
Absolutely, Gerardo. Thank you so much for your time as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.